on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
Every single thing I've ever done has been a seat of the pants writing thing. I just make it up as I go. I have no grand plan. I just concluded a 14 book series arc in the Fatal series, and everybody was asking me for years if I knew who shot so-and-so. I'm like, no. I said, I'll find it out when they do.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Yes, hello and welcome. It is The Self-Publishing Show, the place to be to learn all about the world of indie publishing, soon to be referred to simply as the world of publishing. My name is James Blatch.
My name is Mark Dawson. Hello.
And we should mention, we've just discussed what we're going to talk about before today's fabulous star interview with none other than Marie Force. And I know we're going to get lots of listeners to this podcast, so we have a big audience. Let's use it wisely. Let's not talk about the weather. But let's talk about that article, which was in, I think, Publisher Weekly this week, which was the traditional publishing industry bemoaning the monopoly that they feel Amazon has on the publishing world. And as quite a few people pointed out quite quickly, they didn't moan about the monopoly traditional publishing had on the publishing world for the last 200 years. But it's just a sign, without getting into any debate here, it's a sign that things are definitely changing in the heartlands of publishing.
Absolutely, and have been changing for 10 years or so. I mean, it's, yeah, I saw the article, and they've and we should, I really think we should probably avoid setting this up as a traditional publishing against indie publishing, because as you say, I think it is just publishing, and there are different ways to achieve the getting a book into a reader's hands. It doesn't really matter how you do that. It's just that there are other options that Amazon have helped to introduce over the last decade or so. But it was an interesting article. I mean, they've complained. I think they've filed a complaint suggesting that Amazon is monopolizing publishing, and I don't know if they went as far as to say they should be broken up, but that's certainly something that has been mentioned before. And you know, I don't really see that. I mean, my view on this is that Amazon, when they made their big play into publishing, they took a very big gamble. I don't know how much Amazon and Mr. Bezos invested in a technology that may not have gone anywhere. They could have built the Kindle and then the store, and found out that no one came when it was built. So they took a big gamble on that, millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I think because they took that gamble, they should be entitled to benefit from the success that they've helped to foster. So I don't really see. Yeah, I don't have too much sympathy for that particular argument. And you know, my view is, I think this is just, it's a healthy time to be writing. There's so many different opportunities and possibilities now for us to get our books out there into the world. That's something to celebrate. And you know, if traditional publishing or anybody else wants to take a bite out of Amazon's pie, then they need to innovate as Amazon did. And good luck to them.
Yeah, and there is. There's certainly, in some areas of traditional publishing, there is a resistance to the change. We can see that in the pricing model of trying to support hardbacks and paperbacks against the kind of ebook version, because I guess there's scales of economy and there's profit in that side of the business for them, particularly if you happen to own the printers or you have a very long-standing deal with printers and you suddenly took a percentage of sales away from that and moved them to ebooks, which would be a natural progression, I think, for people, and is a natural progression for people. And you can't really, ultimately, you can't buck that trend. You can try and resist it for a bit. But yeah, I think that innovation, that's the way, you know, if they're going to put some time, effort and innovation into it, rather than finding ways to resist a change that's coming, it's how to embrace it, you know, how to have print on demand in shops, for instance, which is something that I know there's kind of a big clunky machine around that does do that. How to have bookshelves that can allow you to download your ebooks there and then, so you can browse a bookshop but take away the ebook version of it. I think that's something that I don't even know if that happens in the Amazon bookshops, but it seems an obvious thing for me.
Yeah, well, I think just to pick you up on one point there. I mean, there is, I don't know what the statistics are exactly in terms of the split between digital and physical, but it's still, I believe it is still fairly heavily weighted in favor of physical. So that is still the biggest slice of the pie. That is where most people still do their reading. Now, obviously, there is a very large and growing proportion of the population, and this will have been accelerated by COVID, that prefer to read on a digital device, which obviously that's great. But, you know, you just need to look in the, I mean, the bookseller has been posting some figures from the traditional industry just to see how paperback and hardback sales have accelerated as soon as the shops opened after the lockdown. I think it was 20 or 30% up on the corresponding period last year. So it's still a very healthy market. And what was the big release recently? The new Stephanie Meyer Twilight book, which has sold, you know, gazillions of copies in print and in hardback. It's done really, really well. 80 or 90,000 in the UK, I think it was, within the first few days. So that's still a healthy market. And this is all good. You know, none of this is us and them. It's all just readers wanting to read and being given loads of options as to how they can scratch that itch, which is, you know, we should be celebrating that.
Yeah. And there's areas for us to think about as well, about making sure that print is not ignored forever by you. It's something that may not be, or the print on demand is a very easy thing to do on Amazon, on the other platforms, but you know, you've delved into hardbacks now. When you get a bit bigger, there's definitely a money on the table there. I've actually gone back a little bit to paperbacks recently. I took a couple of paperbacks on holiday, which I enjoyed the physical elements because I was sitting by a pool. I could have had my Kindle, I suppose, but I enjoyed the physical aspect of it. And I bought a book to read for a future interviewee on a podcast, which I bought in physical format. And I sit in a red chair in the front of my room, and I actually, you know, it's a little bit retro for me because I've been on the Kindle for some years, but actually quite enjoying having a physical book in my hands again. Do you do much physical book reading?
No, not really. It's almost all on device for me. And I don't have, this is a terrible admission, but I don't have that much time to do kind of reading outside of what I'm working on. So I'll be reading, sometimes reading my own stuff, which is it's a bit masturbatory, I suppose.
But kind of
very, very much so, yeah. So I'll be doing a bit of that just to, you know, when I'm preparing to send stuff off. But no, not. It's been a while, but I haven't had a holiday for a while, so I'm going on holiday next week, and you know, maybe I'll find some time to read a little bit then.
Good. Well, let's have a quick chat about our side project, which may become the all-encompassing, overwhelming project in a few years. We hope it will anyway. Which is Hello Books. You and I, well, a team of lawyers in London, have been very busy getting the articles of a association together and the contracts with various people. I don't think we're at a stage yet where we can announce who's involved in the project, but we have a few names in the industry who are going to be involved in it, and we're getting close to being able to sign with them. But why don't you remind people again, Mark, what this project is and what authors will get out of it?
So Hello Books is a new email marketing platform that will enable readers to find new books and authors to tell readers about their books. So people will be familiar with, you know, BookBub, the gold standard in this particular part of the industry, Free Booksy and the Written Word Media team, and there are others as well who are doing a really good job in getting those messages out to readers. And we feel that we can offer something, a slight variation on that, on that model. So what we are going to be doing is we've been building a website for a while, which looks really, really nice. I've been working on the email that we'll be sending out. And what we'll be offering is a fairly aggressive Facebook marketing strategy over the first year and probably into years two and three. We're aiming to build a list of a million readers within the first 12 months. Those readers will all be self-selecting, so they'll tell us what genres they want to read, and then they'll get emails with books, discounted books and free books in those genres. Probably to start with every 2 weeks, but we'll gradually ramp that up as the list gets bigger and can take more regular emails. And as you say, we can't announce exactly everyone who's involved in the project, but one person I think we can mention is Deepesh Mandalia, who is the Facebook guy. He's been on the podcast right back at the start. He worked for a company called Wonderbly now. In those days, it was called Lost My Name, and he helped them go from a startup basically in publishing to a seven-figure annual turnover with some really, really good Facebook ads. He knows everything about Facebook ads. He's way ahead of where I am in what you can do with them. So he's going to be on board, and we're going to invest pretty heavily in those ads over the first two or three years to see where we are. And I don't know when we're going to launch. It won't be long now, probably September time. So there is a wait list, which I think is, what is it, James?
It is selfpublishingformula.com/hellobooks.
So if you're interested, we've had about 3,000 authors said that they're interested in being involved with that, which is great. And we hope that we'll be able to take as many people on as possible as we start to get the ball rolling. But we'll have more on that in the next week or two, I suspect, if you have a look in the Self-Publishing Formula Facebook community. And I'll probably do a email as well, just letting people know exactly what we have in mind. But we're quite excited to get that ball rolling.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few people that have gone down this route before, and I think the differentiator for us is because of SPF, we're in a position to invest in the list here. We like investing in things as we go ahead. We can't invest $1 million in the first year, but we can invest a lot, and that's going to be the difference. The bread and butter of these lists is how big they are and how vibrant and relevant the list is. So if we can get that bit right, we create something valuable for authors to help them with their career. And I was only today looking at my BookBub deal from June and the wider view of the, in fact, I should post it probably with this podcast. I'll send it to John so he can put it up on the screen if you're watching the YouTube version. It's a fantastic graph where you just see this bimbling along, this spike on the couple of days of the BookBub, and then this slope up of the re-page reads that followed. You know, how valuable that service is when you get it right. So we will try and join them and others in and do things our own way, a slightly different way as well. Okay, good. I've got one more thing to say before we go to our interview, and that is that I did try to pronounce somebody's name who joined us from Patreon recently. His name is Irish, and it's spelt D-E-A-G-L-A-N with an accent over the A, followed by O, followed by H apostrophe A-O-D-H-A. I remember you laughing and saying, do the Patreons, James. And I didn't stand a chance. However, his real name is Declan Hayes. This is his, I think, his Gaelic version of Declan Hayes. He didn't send Declan Hayes in, though, but he has sent in a little audio clip gently pointing out how to pronounce his name.
Declan O'Hay.
Well, I didn't stand a chance, Mark.
No, I wouldn't have either, but it's quite fun seeing you flounder, so that's why I handed it over.
What do you think about having that sort of a name as an author name? In name Declan Hayes, you can read and pronounce it very easily. The Gaelic name, obviously it has some kind of something to it, you know, that kind of, depending on what kind of genre he's writing, it has a bit of a mystique.
It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea. And the reason it's a bad idea is, I do, it's authentic, but it doesn't not really do you any good if they can't go into the bookshop and ask for your name just because they don't know how to pronounce it. So I don't think that's a good idea. Also difficult to spell. So when you go to Amazon, it may not be obvious as to what you should type in. So it is one of those annoying things that, you know, people, it just has to be as convenient as possible. And personally speaking, I would go with Declan for that, just because I think you'll sell more books, which is one of those, it's irritating that you have to say that. But I just think realistically, you're probably hamstringing yourself a little bit if you go for something that's really authentic as opposed to something that's just easy to remember.
There you go. Well, I think Declan's in a position to make a change because he hasn't published his first book yet. But there you go. There's some unsolicited advice for you, should you wish to take it. Declan, thank you very much indeed.
Basically, we've butchered your name and then given you some unsolicited advice. So yeah. Two apologies there.
Thank you for your Patreon support. Okay, look, let's move on to our interview. So this is Marie Force, who was a very early guest on this podcast. She's been literally a force of nature in self-publishing. And indie publishing, one of the greats of this industry. She works incredibly hard, and catching up with her proved to be every bit as fun and valuable as I thought it might be. So here's Marie.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Well, Marie-Force, I'm delighted to have you back on the show. Do you know you were one of our, I think maybe our second guest?
I was early on, I know, yeah.
Really
yeah,
early on.
We nice didn't. To be back.
We had no idea what we were doing. I had no idea what I was talking about. But I know a smidgen more now, but not a lot more. But you know what? The most depressing thing is that I still haven't published my book, and I dread to think how many books you've published in the time between these interviews. But you should probably start. Let's pretend that somebody doesn't know who you are. And you can give me the skinny on who Marie-Force is.
The skinny. Marie-Force wishes she was skinny. So I'm about to publish my 80th book, James.
Wow.
In August. Yeah, I'm super psyched. I'm actually publishing one with Montlake, which is exciting and different for me. I've been with various publishers, and as of August, after I finished the book with Montlake, I'm completely indie, which I'm super psyched about because I just love being able to do my own thing. I even have, I'm continuing the Fatal series that started with Harlequin. I'm going to be continuing it on my own for a time and doing some new and cool things with it. And so it's just nice to be able to do what you want when you want. It's so, so very cool. I'm going to take August off. I'm going to go all rogue and take a month off.
Wow. Well, you deserve
because
it.
Because I can.
Yeah, because you can.
Because I've written like a million words this year already. So I'm kind of like, the pandemic has been really good for my output, which I know is not the case for everyone, but I've had a really good couple of months. So
and
I
said
if I could get to X point, I would take, you know, a month off. So
well, that's one of the beauties of this lifestyle, isn't it? And
yeah, it is.
Was the reading up as well? Were you seeing your books being consumed up during the pandemic?
Oh God, yes, yes. And I moved a couple of new releases up because I realized, you know, I can't do anything for my readers trapped at home except for give them something to read. So, and they were super appreciative. A couple of the books, one of them they'd been waiting a really long time for, and they were super psyched to get it early. And it just was great. And so it's been, the numbers are great this year. And I feel almost guilty saying that because I know so many people are suffering right now. I see it in my own life, friends who own restaurants and, you know, every form of business is in tough shape right now. And it makes me feel almost a little bit guilty to be like, yeah, not mine.
Yeah, well, I understand that. But of course, we shouldn't feel guilty because it's really important that the economy flourishes where it can. And in the long term, that will help everyone. So
I think so. And also, you know, I've been keeping my social media really focused on like the entertainment value, the funny dog stories, the funny, like I have my 20 something kids home with me. We're thrilled. They're not. So the one that just helped me get connected to you is 25 and lives in New York City most of the time. And so for her to be home in like Podunk, Rhode Island, she's like, oh.
Yeah.
But she, you know, it's been that part of it's been great. It's like having my kids home again, you know. So
we've never had so much family time. And I think,
know. And I mean, I don't hate it. They kind of do, I think. Yeah, but there's a beer pong table up in my bonus room over my garage now and things like that. But cool. You know, whatever. They're both legal, so.
Oh yeah, so beer pong is actual beer pong. Okay, yeah. Well, look, I want to talk about a few things, but we certainly want to talk to you about process because I think people are really interested in the way that you apply yourself and you plan out series and so on. But let's talk a little bit about the publishing journey then, because I think when we spoke to you before, you really did have a load of books being published and a load of books being indie, and you seem to have made a decision there.
Yeah, I definitely have. I was hybrid, quote unquote, for 10 years. I'll be indie published for the first time in November of 2010. So I'm coming up on my 10th anniversary as an indie. I think I was one of the first to be completely hybrid, which was before hybrid was a term I think that Bob Mayer termed at some point. And I definitely have been continuously traditionally published for 12 years since 2008. And at the same time doing indie, and I just, I really do favor the indie side of things. I'm sure my publishers are really glad that I've decided to go indie because I'm very willful about what I like and what I don't, and what I know works and what I know doesn't work. I also find it to be extremely frustrating that traditional publishers do nothing with backlist. You know, I've got my backlist humming. All the books that I've published, like between 50 or 60 indie books, and they're all making money for me all the time. And with the traditional side, that's not the case. You know, the backlist is allowed to languish a little bit because they're very focused on what's next and not what's behind them. And I always think if they only realized what an asset they have in the backlist the way we do, you know, it just kind of, it's a little bit astonishing to me. Yeah. I'll be honest, I have contracts that have not earned out, because there's no promotion on the backlist. So, you know, you can't, like, books aren't going to sell on their own. They're just not. And so I find that to be enormously frustrating. And so it was better for me not to continue to be traditionally published because I like to be able to do something about that.
Yeah. That's very odd, isn't it, really? Cause it's a product.
It's astonishing to me, especially with what they pay. What they were paying me towards the end, and, you know, don't you want to do everything you can to recoup that investment is my thought, you know, but they don't. And I don't honestly understand how the lights stay on.
So some authors, maybe the lights won't stay on forever, certainly not in their current form. Let's see. But some authors struggle with the business side, don't they? They love the writing and they quite enjoy some of the marketing, but still find it difficult to move their kind of change their heads over. It seems to me, Marie, you've got a very, very good business savvy approach to this. There's no, like, for instance, a lot of people get caught up in their relationship with the traditional industry, whereas I can imagine you sitting down with your contemporaries by the sounds of it and you telling them what's what, rather than it being you feeling.
I mean, I'm sure they don't like me very much. I have no doubt that they all can't stand me, and I'm kind of okay with that because, like, I have figured out on my side of things, like, if you look, I'm about to hit the 10 million books sold mark, and of that, almost 8 million of those books are indies. And so I know how to sell books, and I know what works for my readers. I know. And they don't, none of them ever want to hear it. You know, they're just very married to the way it's always been. And I find that to be just, you know, not, it doesn't work for me. It did for a while, and then it just suddenly didn't. And listen, I want to say something. I always tell the story when traditional publishers have given me a few thrills that I could not have had without them. And one of them, the best one ever, is really close to my late dad, who just died in 2018. And one day we were in his grocery store, right around the time when Harlequin had released the first 9 Fatal books in print to try to catch up, because it originally had been at Carina, and it was digital only. And then they decided they were going to put it into mass market paper at book 10, which was kind of a bummer because it's kind of late in the series to be starting in mass market. But they brought out the first 9 books all at once, and so the shelves were full of them. And I was in my dad's grocery store, and we spotted them on the shelves, and he flipped out. I mean, like, I had like 5 or 6 books on the shelf. He was calling people over, you know, and like, that was the thing. That was one of those like moments that you'll just never forget. And I never could have done that on my own. I could not have achieved that moment with him, which I will never forget. I have pictures, you know. He was so blown away to see 6 of my books on the shelf at his particular grocery store. And so, like, it still gives me the chills to think about that moment with him.
Yeah.
And how excited he was. And I wouldn't have had that without traditional publishing. So I'm really thankful for those opportunities and to walk into Barnes & Noble to this day and see tons of my books on the shelves, which would not have happened without multiple traditional publishers. But like I said, you know, the downside is your backlist is allowed to like languish, like, you know, I mean, what it could be making and what it is making is kind of a little bit sad compared to what my indie books make on a monthly basis. So,
yeah. And we should remember that seeing your book on the bookshelf and at the airport is for some people their measure of success.
Absolutely. And there's no question that that's a thrill. That never gets old. And, you know, by that time, my dad had certainly, he'd been to book signings with me. He'd been to my reader weekend that I have every year where my readers come from all over. And he'd been to all that. But something about seeing all those books in his grocery store on the shelf, like 6 of them. I mean, it was amazing. You know, it was fabulous. And I'll never forget that. I mean, and now, especially now that he's gone, you know, I called him the chairman of the board of my company because he called me every morning to make sure I was up and writing. And that was his job.
Wow.
His only job in the company.
I'm starting to see where it came from, that drive. That's brilliant. What a lovely story. So, and I'm sorry you lost your dad so recently.
Oh, but thank you.
Thanks. So lovely that he shared your career and is a part of who you are today. So.
He totally is. Both of my parents. My mom's been gone for 16 years. And so he and I became very close after we lost her. And, you know, he was like my best girlfriend. So, but he was 84. And it hadn't occurred to me or my brother that he was actually old. Mm. So
it was a shock, yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, hey, you slipped into that answer about 1.5 minutes ago that you are coming up on 10 million books sold.
Yeah, in the next month or so, it should happen. My accountant, CFO, is keeping an eye on that. She's like, she wants to be the first to know when we hit that moment, you know. Well, so it's very close, very, very, very close.
That is absolutely fantastic, Marie. Yeah, you're so well named because you're a force of nature in this industry.
I joke that I married well in the name department. That name is 100% my husband's.
It's a great name. It works on every level, doesn't it?
But, and my first editor said to me, when you have a last name like Forrest, you do not have a pen name, because I did not want to write under my real name. She's like, oh no, you're writing under that name.
Don't.
But you asked me about Forrest. The business thing too, and I did want to get back to that, because I hear a lot of people say, oh, I couldn't do what you do, blah, 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 because I don't have the business, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I just like to say, like, I didn't have it either until I needed it. So my dad and my brother were always self-employed, and I used to be so envious because I used to think, oh God, that would be so awesome. But then I would think, I need to know where my next paycheck's coming from, you know, like I'm very married to like that, like I'm low risk, you know, kind of. And so I didn't know the business side of it until I had to, you know, I had my books kind of took off in 2011 in a way that I never could have imagined. And I had to figure it out. I had to figure it out very quickly. And if that happens to you, then you cope with it, which, I mean, it's a good problem to have, quote unquote problem. Mm. But, you know, you figure out very quickly that if you don't get the tax situation under control, that you're basically putting cash in front of an open window, you know, and just letting it blow towards the government when it could be coming back to you, you know. So you figure it out. You figure it out. I will admit that I had a little bit more than the average person of a marketing background. I had built websites before. I had done social media stuff before with other jobs, and was an editor in my old job and communications director. So I had like some skills that maybe not everyone would have going into this. But I definitely have learned what I needed to know as I went with this.
So on the marketing front, how is your operation today? Because I think you've had a few people working for you when we spoke last time.
Yeah, and I still do. Yeah. But marketing wise, it's pretty much me, myself, and I, and one other person. I have kind of, and this is when you and I kind of reconnected, because I bought Mark's class a long time ago, and I never took it. But a lot of people probably do this, right? Because you get so busy. But what's occurred to me as I close in on 80 books is that nobody knows those 80 books the way I do. And like, I can hire a lot of people to do a lot of different things, but if they don't really understand the books and the targets and who they should be targeting them to and what other authors and what other books and blah, 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 then, you know, it's like, there's a lot of opportunity lost in not knowing that, you know, because you can hire an awesome ad person, and I've worked with several of them, but they had never read my books. They don't know what I'm about. They don't know, you know, my core story, or, and I can tell them that to a point, you know, to a point. And then, I don't know. So I've kind of recently, this is like my new thing. I'm trying to like, you know, figure things out. My new thing is that I am trying to take control of my ads. Has been really challenging because it's a lot harder than it looks.
We saw your name pop up last month on the ads course. Yeah. And it's a bit of a surprise that someone closing in on 10 million books is learning. Yeah. Because I'm trying to think what you haven't done well so far to get to where you are.
What I'm trying to do, though, I'm going to close out at my daughter's Facebook is chiming here. So what I'm trying to do, though, is to never be satisfied. You know, I like to keep, you know, keep staying a little bit like hungry, if you will, and be like, okay, what's the next big thing? What can we do, you know, that we're not doing? And I just had a really, really good release for the third. So I have four different series going right now. And the one of them's new, so I'm not counting that one. But so like the third best selling one, which was started with a traditional publisher that refuses to do like first and series free and stuff. And the overall sales for that series have suffered from that. So the very first book, there's no freebie, you know? And so I can tell you that books with fewer series have sold more because I'm able to do a freebie, you know, of the first book, which we all know is just, you know, it's just, that's like book selling 101, you know? But, so the one I just released is probably like that series is number three, as far as sales. And it just did really, really well. And the only thing that I did differently was to really bump up the ads with my own hand on them.
Right.
And so I've already seen like just a really great return on that investment.
Yeah. So, and are these Facebook ads or Amazon ads you're...
I'm mostly focusing on Amazon right now. I've really done a lot with Facebook in the past. And I don't want to say that I've tapped out that market, but I just feel like I haven't done enough with Amazon yet. And one of my good friends is really savvy on this and she's killing it with Amazon ads. So I'm really focused right now on that module of the course. I've got a little off track because my boat's in the water now and it's my boat season. Right. So I've got to get back to that.
That's not a metaphor. It's an actual boat in the water.
So in addition to my father leaving me this dog who is always with me.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, that was his dog. So I have two of my own and now I have his too. I also got my father's 40-foot boat. Yes, that is not a metaphor. My boat is actually in the water.
The boat is in the water. Okay.
Yes, the boat has a new captain. I've been kind of like a little bit sidetracked by getting the boat in the water and stuff, but I'm getting back to it this weekend and I'm really excited about it because it's, you know, I feel like it's so cool to be able to take control of that and to kind of like put the things that I've learned over 12 years of being published and, you know, indie published and traditional published and take all of that and put it towards like targeting those Amazon ads and really kind of watching them, seeing how they do. And it's kind of a little bit addictive.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm now marketing books in our little imprint, and it's for an author who's passed away to try and again all backlist, and it's
right.
You know, watching that
backlist is where the gold is.
You know, watching that go up every month, it's one of the most exciting things I've done in a couple of years of business.
It is fun. It's really fun, and you know, I also did something last year that I said I would never do, and I put some books into KU, and I did that for a very specific reason. Actually, one of my author friends kind of called me out about it recently, and she's like, "You said never," and I said, "I know." Until I had a reader tell me that with as many books as like, say, my Gansett Island series is going into book 23. And if somebody is new to it, like that's an awful lot of money for somebody to spend to get all the way through the series. So it really does open up the long series to readers who wouldn't be able to access them otherwise. And so I'm kind of a convert to that way of thinking. And it's but trust me, I hate the exclusivity. I hate all the things that everybody else hates about it. But I found that I really did find a lot of new readers at Amazon with that. I really did.
Yeah.
And so I put Gansett back in for the summer. It's a great summer beach read kind of series.
Well, there's
I put it back in for a second tour.
Yeah, there's no question there that there are some voracious readers who are just in Kindle Unlimited because why would they look anywhere else? They get an endless supply.
Of course, it's
every
such a great deal for people, especially people who right now who are on very fixed income because of you know, layoffs and unemployment. The U.S. is out of control and everywhere else, I'm sure, but it's really bad here. And add to that too, just the length of the series is very daunting to somebody coming into it new. So I wanted to make it more accessible to those readers. And I am definitely still opposed to KU for all the same reasons we all are, you know. But, you know, there is a definite benefit to people who don't have a lot of disposable income to be able to have access to my books, as many of them as I can give them for a time, and then put them back on the other retailers. I always want to have everything available everywhere. And of course, one exception is going to be this series that starts with Montlake. And then I've got book two coming right after it. Montlake didn't want book two, which is totally fine. But so I just am publishing my own. I'm going to continue the series on my own.
Okay.
And like, yeah.
So I was going to ask you about the traditional deals that you've done. Are they life and 70 years type thing? Are you not going to get those books back, or are you?
No, I won't get them back. They won't come back to me. Probably when my kids are grandparents. But you know what? It's fine. I especially in the latter half of my traditional publishing time, I made sure that I got paid as much as I would ever hope to make on a book. You know, I mean, like, I'm totally like, if I never see another dime, you know, I have nothing to complain about. So that was kind of my philosophy after a while, is like, okay, I'll do it, but I'm going to get the money up front, you know? Yeah. So,
well, that's another power of indie, isn't it? And we had this conversation with Bella Andre a little while ago, that she suddenly found out, because of the indie rise, she found herself in a position, instead of sitting opposite somebody in the industry, not really knowing where her books would be and how to argue or negotiate, she turned her laptop around and showed the spreadsheet. So, well, this is what I'm doing, so you need to match this. And suddenly she had a 7-figure deal for a series of books. And
that's exactly right. And I mean, and even like, you know, Bella and I started out together. We laugh a lot about just some of the funny stuff that we've seen. Like, we both indie published right around the same time. And I still was traditionally published. I had two contracts when I first published, when I published my first indie book, November 18th of 2010, the day that changed my life forever. And I, wasn't sure if we were going to get sued. I said to my husband, something bad could happen, but if it doesn't, then something good could happen. And so that was kind of how I told him, yeah, we might get sued, because even like my agent at the time didn't know, nobody knew, because there was no non-compete language for indies at that time at all. It had not in the indie in this new format that we were basically inventing at that moment. And I just remember thinking like, oh my God, because I put the book out in November and then I put another one out in December. Because I had written a ton of books before I actually sold one. I sold my 7th book. So I had all these other ones already, like, and every single new thing I learned, I went back and applied it to all of them. Like, when I learned about POV and I learned about this and I learned about that, I would go back and fix them all, you know? So when this door opened, I was ready. And I didn't even know what I was preparing for all that time, but I was ready for it. So I just started 2011. I just started putting them on sale like one a month. And then I published Gansett 3 months in a row. And that was the game changer. But one of my first publishers put a book on sale for free in February of 2011 for a week. And that sent everything like flying, like all those new books that I had made like $50 a month on, like those first indies, $110 the second month. Suddenly I'm making $10,000 a month, because of that one freebie where they go, what else does she have? You know? And suddenly like those books that I quietly put on sale are now, you know, making me $10,000 a month. And
do you think that works particularly well in your genre, where people consume books quickly?
Definitely.
And probably, I don't know what page length you are, probably slightly shorter than some of the other genres, are they? Yeah, 200, yeah, less than 300, just looking at one of your Gansetts.
My books are longer than most of the contemporary. Mine are still are in the 80s to 90,000 word most of the time. I have a few that are 50, 60, but most of them are more. But I did a permanent freebie with Gansett, got to like 6 or 7 books. I put Made for Love, the first book, up for free and gave away like something like 1.2 million copies of Made for Love, but then sold 4 million copies of the series, you know? So a lot of people will say like, oh, I can't bear the idea of a free book. And I just say, I'm really sorry that you feel that way, because it's the best way to introduce yourself to a reader that would never try you otherwise, you know? So, and that's the benefit of the KU thing too, is like a short stint in KU, you're not going to necessarily sell your soul to the devil, you know? You're just going to like meet new readers.
It's smart. It's marketing. It's what I mean about changing heads and not thinking of it as your baby that you don't want to give away. It's about, it's a marketing decision, right?
It's a commodity.
You've nailed that. I think that side of things.
And I would also say too, like having my catalog in KU when my Montlake book hits is probably not a dumb idea either.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so.
Sure. So you mentioned Gansett Island, and I did notice that book 23 of 23 is now in pre-order. It looks to be up on KDP, and
it's the gift that keeps on giving, that series.
Well, but it's got an end, doesn't it? There it is. It looks to me quite a dark cover. And
So Blackout After Dark is going to be the island has a power failure.
Okay.
And it's going to be a catch up with everybody. So we're going to have a chapter or a section or whatever, where every single one of the past couples is going to have an impact of that power failure. It's going to be days long, in the middle of the summer. They're going to have a power failure. So that's what the blackout is.
That sounds fun. When I saw the cover, I thought, oh, is Marie moving into different territories and going into
Marie cannot do paranormal, because Marie can't. I have no suspension of disbelief button. I'm just like, what? Come on. You know?
Because love is real, so you can...
Love is real, yeah. Yes. I can definitely handle that. But I can't do paranormal. I can't read that. Anytime I'm reading paranormal, I'm like, that could not happen. I'm not the paranormal customer that people want. So
let's talk a little bit about process. And then, so Gansett Island started, I guess, back in 2010, did you say? It was
2011, but I wrote it in 2007 and okay. Shopped it all around to every romance publisher in the business, which thank God they all rejected it. So yeah. Now I'm just like, oh, I'm living in a lovely house that Gansett Island bought me. Yeah. So,
And tell me how you approached it in those early days. Did you approach it thinking this was going to be a long running series or
No, not at all. In fact, I don't plan anything beyond the next book. I really just don't. I never have. I'm not a plotter. I'm a full on, every single thing I've ever done has been a seat of the pants writing thing. I just make it up as I go. I have no grand plan. I just concluded a 14 book series arc in the Fatal series. And everybody was asking me for years if I knew who shot so-and-so. I'm like, no, I said, I'll find it out when they do. And it was quite shocking. Let me just tell you what ended up happening.
You sat there think, wow.
I was like, really? And I feel like that keeps me engaged, that I don't know what's going to happen. Like because I really feel like my ADD would kick in and I'd get bored if I knew like every single thing ahead of time. I'd get bored with the story. I like those moments where you're like, shut up. Like something just happened, you know. For example, I was writing the new book in my Vermont series. And one of the brothers, it's a 10 siblings in the family. And one of the brothers called one of the other brothers a nickname that was all new in book 11. And I was like, oh my God, how funny. Like it just came out of nowhere. And his name is Max and they called him MaxiPad. And I was just like, where did that come from? And like, I love that I don't know that that's coming, you know? And so the readers loved that. They were like, oh my God, poor Max. And so Max's book is coming up. So now we know a little bit more about what the torture he's been through as the youngest of 10 kids, you know?
It's shaped him, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. He's got identical twin brothers right ahead of him and they drive him crazy. So we got a good, you know, just, it was a good little like piece of their family that I'm still discovering 11 books into the series. So, and I love that. I don't want to know all that ahead of time. You know, so, I want that to pop up in book 11.
So it's you sit down to your writing in the way that a reader sits down to read a book.
I do. And I write linear. I write beginning, middle, end, just write. And then I go back as I write and I go back and check and double check and make sure that I'm, especially like with my Fatal books that are very windy, twisty, murder mystery built in with some politics and some romance and all sorts of stuff going on. The pacing of those books is way faster than anything else I write. So I have to make sure that I'm kind of closing all those loops and stuff with that. And so I do a lot of rereading. So
you do write,
as I go.
You write a draft in a linear sense. You go from beginning to end.
And then I'm constantly going back while I'm writing and I'm doing cleanup.
Okay. So by the time you get to the end,
I end up with a pretty clean first draft that I am pretty could send to editing if I had to. And so I try to write like, so I was a copy editor in my old job. I've always been like a writer, editor, reporter. So I don't like skip over like crap sentences or typos or, you know, and go back and deal with them later. I deal with it in the moment because I don't want to have to write a book twice or three times. I don't have time for that. With the schedule that I try to keep. So, and keeping those, like writing four series, I try to keep the books coming, you know, so the readers are constantly getting something new. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask on that point, do you ever find yourself going back maybe sort of a third of the book and thinking, I want to redo this from a story point of view, or is it always just smaller things that you correct?
It's mostly small stuff because I am very, very, very judicious about not writing something that I feel is crap. I mean, why would I waste my, I have so little, we all have so little time, you know, to spend doing the things that we need to do so that we can get to do the things we want to do. And writing for me is still as much of a joy as it always was. And I think that that's a really big part of longevity in this career is that if you hate it, if it's torture, if it's something you don't want to do every day, I can't imagine how anybody does that. I just can't. For me, it's still one of the greatest joys of my life, being able to sit and just like let all this just come out, you know. So I don't know where it comes from. I'm not asking any questions. I just hope it keeps coming. I've always sort of thought it was my mom, my late mother, who died right before I really got serious about this. And she's kind of feeding me all this good stuff, you know? And like, I like to think that there's some sort of like divine intervention going on because I don't know where it comes from. So
best not to question it though.
Is absolutely best not to question these things. I just am very happy that it continues to come.
Mark is exactly the same. He never wants to teach anyone how to write because he says he doesn't know. He doesn't know how it works.
I could never teach people how to write. I can tell people like how I do it and tell them, you know, I always say do whatever works for you.
Yeah.
My process is very like everybody who knows me makes fun of me because when we go on vacation or whatever, I write in bed. And I have this like typing like style where everything is all, and they're like, oh my God, if anybody could see this, it's like watching sausage being made. Like nobody wants to see sausage being made, but you hope it tastes good at the end. You know, it's kind of like that.
So fingers everywhere. So you're like, so in bed.
Yeah, and I'm like in the bed, like, oh.
Is this in the morning or in the evening? When are you?
Oh, I write best in the morning. So when I was first doing this, I was writing around two young kids and a full-time day job that I did from home. So I would get them, you know, fed and bathed. The work is done for the day. Like off to bed they go. And I would start writing then. So like from like 8 to midnight. And I did that for years. And then when I started writing full time in January 1st of 2012, after my big 2011, I quit my 16-year day job to write full time. And cried my eyes out too because I loved that job. I loved that boss. But I, you know, you just get to a point where you can't do two full-time jobs anymore. And I had to train myself that I was allowed to write during the day. Like it took me 3 months to really kind of make that transition where like, because I was very faithful about the job I was getting paid to do. I did that job during the day. Like I didn't want to be like one of those people who was like cheating the boss, you know, and like the company had been very good to me. And I worked at home for 13 years while my kids were young because of them. And it was very important to me to do the job I was getting paid to do. And then, so now I'm allowed to write during the day, but my brain has not made the switch yet, you know? So it took a couple months. It really did to kind of transition to, but now I'm super protective of the morning writing time. Amazon asked me to do this. Like, I think it might've been a podcast. I can't remember what it was. But I had to film it at 10 a.m. on a weekday. And I said, no, because like I will lose that whole day. If I do something at 10 a.m. on a weekday, forget it. It'll mess up my mojo for the whole day.
That's your writing time.
Yeah, it's my writing time, and I don't do appointments. I don't do everything I do is late afternoon.
I'm going to get into the granular detail here of your morning routine. You presumably have breakfast downstairs, but then you just decamp back up to the bedroom, and that's your writing position.
I get up really crazy early. I wait for my husband to get up. And then, so I'm doing this intermittent fasting. So I don't eat breakfast and I drink a cup of black coffee, which I had to train myself to drink black coffee, but it's working. I'm losing like crazy, which is awesome. But, so then I go back up to, I go back to bed.
Okay.
And what the funny joke too, is when he gets up ahead of me, he makes the bed with me in it. Cause he knows I'm not going to make it and he knows I'm not going to get out of it.
So you're lying on bed. I mean, I think Alicia Hyder, a couple of other people I've spoken to, they like sort of lying on bed and doing it. I think
Carly Phillips writes in bed too, and we're all paying for it with neck and shoulder.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think my back would suffer.
There's nothing ergonomic about it.
Okay.
One of my cousins said, you need to get an ergonomic expert in here. I said, yeah, they take one look at this situation and be like, yeah.
It'd ruin everything.
But again, you don't mess with what works, you know?
No, exactly. And how long do you write for? Do you have a kind of word count aim?
I write most in the morning. I do some marketing stuff first thing. And then I do, you know, some Facebook stuff, some Instagram, blah, blah, blah. I quit Twitter last year and I don't miss it at all. So I just definitely just try to get the stuff out of the way that has to get done. Like if there's books that need to be signed, I have people that help me with the shipping and all that. So if I sign the books early, then they can come and get them whenever and ship them out for me. So I do all that stuff early and then I go right into the writing. I try to write 2,000 a day on the book that is, due next. And then if there's any gas in the tank after that, then I work on the one after that. So okay. I have at least two going all the time.
Okay. And when you've got to the end, you say a pretty clean draft because you've been going back as you go mm-hmm. along. What do you do with that draft at that point?
So I do a deep reread, clean it up even more. Then it goes to two of my beta readers have been with me from the very beginning. and they do a big cleanup. And then it goes to copy editing, same copy editor for all 50, 60 of my indie books. I've had the same copy editor. And then I have a really, really good proofreader who's super, she asks like lots of like meaty questions, like, what do you mean by this? And what do you mean, you know, da, da, da. So she's really good. And then I have this new thing that I started last year because of the long series that I can't possibly keep every detail in my head anymore. Despite the fact, if I'm not writing one of my books, I'm rereading. I'm a big rereader with the series because you have to. You absolutely have to. So I have this, what I call the last line of defense beta readers who are consider themselves to be experts in the series, because I have all these reader groups for the various series on Facebook, and they're like, I'm starting my reread. And I'm like, I'm terrified of you people because you know the series better than I do if they reread it before every book. So I asked, I got a dozen of them for each series, and they're all under NDAs and whatnot. And they read the book last. And like, they pick up all the last minute stuff. They find some continuity. Well, in this book, you said that. And so the reason I did this, I've learned the hard way that you always have to read the most recent book before you put the new one out in a long series. Right. So that one I've learned the hard way, done that. Okay. But what happens is, so like a couple that got together in book one, get married in book 13, and you refer to the bride's father giving her away, but the bride's father was referred to as dead in book 4. That's a problem.
Yeah. So you can, you're not doing paranormal.
Yes. And you can reread the book before, but you can't read, you know, 12 books before. And like, so that's where the last line of defense beta readers have become super useful to me, because they know that, you know, they are like, they reread it all. They reread the series a couple times a year. Yeah. So
you've got an army behind you, not just the people, the VAs or the people you employ, the assistants. You've got an army of readers who are integral to your operation.
They are. They have become such. Yes. And now I have a whole new. So I'm writing a series, The Miami Nights, set in Miami, which I'm not a big fan of setting series in real places, because it sets you up for all sorts of secondary challenges. I like to make up my own places, but I wanted to set the series in Miami because South Florida has always played a big part in my life. And I've always wanted to set a book there. And of course, you know, South Florida and Miami is one of the most diverse parts of the U.S., huge Cuban American population there. And, you know, you want to make sure you're doing it right. I mean, if you're going to have a half Cuban, half Italian, you know, but obviously like she's like second or third generation. So it's not like she's not like right from Cuba, my character, but yet her grandmother remembers living in Cuba, or her great grandmother did, you know, so you got to make sure you're doing it right. And so I recruited a bunch of readers specifically for that series, and they have just been instrumental to me and making sure that, you know, you don't want to, if you're going to do something that's outside of your own awareness, you need to make sure that you're doing everything you can to get it right. And they've been just great. I met a woman, I had, my character's name is Carmen. She's half Cuban, half Italian. Her family owns a big half Cuban, half Italian restaurant in Miami that's very famous, you know, so it was great. So I went to Miami twice in the process. I toured Little Havana, you know, I did every single thing I could. And then I had a lunch for my readers in Miami, and I invited them to come and have lunch with me. And one of them was a woman named Carmen who came to the U.S. from Cuba as an 8-year-old.
Wow.
And was put on a plane with her 6-year-old brother and sent to an aunt or an uncle she had never met. So like, talk about a beta reader.
Yeah.
I was like, excuse me, could I send you my book? You know, and now she's like integral to like that series. She's like the first person I go to, and I'm like, when I have a question or whatever. And so listen, I can't possibly have known or experienced the Cuban American experience, but I can certainly write a character and do the best that I can to portray what her life in 2020 might be like. You know, 60 years removed from the Cuban Revolution. And I did a huge deep dive on the Cuban Revolution. I had to keep saying to myself, she doesn't even know. Okay. Yeah. This was her great grandmother. It wasn't her, you know, so I had to kind of tone down my desire to bring all that into the story, you know, and just realize, okay, well, my 30 something year old or 29 year old heroine is from Florida.
Yeah. And the truth is, it's probably a relationship where the parents want them to be interested in Cuba's past, but their kids in jeans right. and just want to be Americans. And
right. And I just likely. Had, well, she's very true to her traditions and her heritage and her family and all of that, but she's very much a woman of 2020 as yeah. well, you know, so, and she's a police widow. You know, so there's a lot going on in there, and I just absolutely love the first two books in this series. I'm super excited about it. I think it's going to be a fun new series, but definitely a challenge to make sure that I'm writing that, you know, the new city and the new characters and the new family properly. And so I put a lot of effort into it. I really hope it, you know, people love it. So.
Well, what, you know, what struck me when we spoke last time a couple of years ago was your closeness to your readers and the way mm-hmm. you've developed that, that makes it sound cynical, but it's been an organic thing, I think, for you, is just to become a growing part of this huge fan base. And you're based in Rhode Island, as you said, I think it's where you are now.
Yeah.
And once a year you have to, is there a name for this festival? That's
just Reader Weekend. And unfortunately we weren't able to have it this year. And I'm really missing it because it's become like so much more than, like, so my assistant, my full-time, you know, fabulous assistant who I met in my previous job, when the 16-year job, she is a meeting planner by trade. And that, so she put on the conferences and I did all the communications and publications for the conferences. So we worked very closely together. And I could not do this without her. She's, you know, she's an expert at negotiating hotel contracts and, you know, all that stuff. So the two of us together, when she started with me in 2013, I wanted, the readers were saying, come here, come here, come here. Well, I still had kids in school and I was going to have kids in school for the next 5 years. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be running all around going to reader events and doing stuff like to feed my ego, or that's how it would have felt to me while they're still at home. I want to be with them. I don't want to look back at their high school years and have missed the games and the, you know, I wanted to be home. So I said, let's bring them to me, you know? And so that's what we did. And so we had this, that has now taken on a life of its own. So the readers have all become friends with each other. And a lot of them come every year so they can see, not just me, I've almost become secondary, so they can see their friends, you know, and we have people come from Ireland. We have people come from Canada, Australia. It's crazy. It's taken on this like unbelievable, Julie and I never could have seen that coming. So everybody is heartbroken. So we're going to try to do a Zoom Reader Weekend at some point.
Yeah.
This year. And then we're having it in DC next year because we had told them we were going to shake things up a little bit and take it on the road. And so one of my Fatal series is set in DC. So we're going to do it in Julie's hometown next year. And so we were going to announce that at the end of Reader Weekend 2020. And so we told them where we were going. And so now everybody's psyched to do something different next year. So.
And when you're among the crowd of your readers, people who know your universe better than you do, as you pointed out, do you find those conversations, in fact, I suppose it's quite good that you don't know what's happening in the future. Because if you're like,
yeah, they always want to know, like, and they've learned that I don't give previews because I don't, like, I keep telling them, I don't know.
Like, that's a perfect answer.
When they come asking me, like, who shot Skip and who this, and is Sam going to have a baby? And this, I'm like, I don't know, you know? Yeah. So like, I literally, so the hero of my Fatal series started off as the chief of staff to a United States senator who was murdered in the first book as his best friend. And the best friend's father is a retired senator who tapped my guy to take the seat after his son was murdered. And so he becomes a United States senator in the second book. And in the 9th or 10th book, I decide, like, so the sitting vice president of the United States ends up with a brain tumor. And they tap the most popular senator is my guy. And they ask him to be vice president. And so I run with that stuff. If I get a big idea like that, I run with it. And like, so I brought in, like, I have this whole cast now of Secret Service agents. And like, there's all this, like, will he, won't he, will he, won't he, will he run, will he not run, will, you know, what's going to happen next with his career now? Everybody's, because like the focus of that series is really on her. And, you know, she's a homicide lieutenant. And so now she's running around without Secret Service protection, which she's not obligated to have and not required to have. So like, that's a whole issue, you know, so.
But you don't know the answers to these questions.
No,
so that's great.
I just, I remember going to lunch with my husband and my father, and I was like, I'm thinking about doing something. And they were like, oh God, what? And I'm like, I think I might make Nick vice president. And they were like, oh God, thank God you weren't going to like sell your house or like move or, you know.
But this is a big thing. I remember.
Like, you have no idea. This is huge. So
I remember J.K. Rowling being interviewed in the middle of writing Harry Potter. And the whole interview was because she'd written the end. She'd scoped it all out. And the whole interview was tiresome for her because they just wanted to find out, you know, what was going to happen. And she said, I'm not talking. And I thought she probably doesn't leave her home. But then, and so that's why I was thinking about you being amongst your fans. But you've got this perfect way of writing, which is it's as much an adventure for you as it is for them.
Right. Well, what I love about it, though, is that we're like, they're super excited. As long as they're super excited for more, then I'm doing what I need to do. And I was really worried actually about because I actually killed off a pretty main character. I've done it twice now in the Fatal series. Fatal series is a little bit different than I would never kill off a main character in Gansett or my Vermont series. But in Fatal, I mean, you know, it's a little bit more of a, you know, what bleep happens kind of series. And and it was somebody who had been like in very poor health and blah, blah, blah. So, but when I did that, I was really concerned that they were going to not be happy. Like they were going to be upset about it. So I was going to not tell them. And then I decided, no, that's wrong. They're very invested. Like these people start to feel like real people to them. I have to tell them this is going to happen. And I totally changed my mind about that. Like I had even asked, it was the book going to be published with Harlequin. I'd asked them to put it on lockdown too, because I was just afraid that they were going to freak out. And they did freak out. But they, I told them, I said, you have to trust me. You have to trust me. Okay. Like I've gotten you this far. And I will say that it's kind of ironic that I was writing that book when my father fell ill.
Right.
And it was Sam's father who was passing away. He was a quadriplegic from book one. He'd been shot on the job. And like, that was a case that was unsolved and all that. And so in book 14, he passes away suddenly. And so while I was writing about my character's father dying, my own father fell ill and died. So Sam and I lost our fathers together, which is like, you know, just kind of like this crazy thing that you just can't explain it to people. Like, unless it's just so weird. My father was perfectly fine when I started writing that book and then was gone by the time I finished it.
Right.
So, yeah. So, I mean, stuff like that, they're very invested. So it's like, do you tell them? Do you not tell them? And I did tell them. And they all said to me that they were glad to have had the warning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, well, how special do they feel being part of your group? And it's so generous of you. And there's so many authors, I think, just wouldn't feel confident about doing it. And some don't see it as anybody's business and kind of don't look at readers in that way. But you have a family. It's amazing.
I share my journey with them, you know, and like they know, like, it's kind of a funny story. So like my dad's boat is the Sea Wings. It was my parents' boat. They both loved it. We've had it for 32 years and I just did a huge renovation of it. And I bought t-shirts for all the people that have helped me keep this massive, I mean, this is a big 40-foot boat that it has old engines in it and stuff. And there's been a lot of people involved in me being able to keep it. And so I bought these like crew t-shirts for all my friends and family who'd been helping me with the boat. And I had a bunch of them left over. So we put them in my store. And I said, told the readers, I was like, okay, well, they were gone like in 2 hours. And I said to my daughter, I'm like, why do they want those shirts? And she said, because they're invested in the story of you keeping your dad's boat.
Yeah.
They are invested in it and they want to be part of it. And I thought, that is so cool. You know, that they really, like, that's my relationship with them. Like, they know that I've got his dog, you know, and I tell funny stories about the dog waking me up like he used to. And so like we're in each other's lives, you know, and I talk to them every day in some form or fashion, you know, but I try to keep it. All my stuff is always very like, you know, it's all about the entertainment value. And trust me, it's very difficult in this world that we live in to not go political on my author pages. I want to badly, but I try to keep my area as kind of like a sanctuary for them. My books and my social media is kind of like a place where they can come and kind of hang out and know that they're not, they can get away from that for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. There's nothing, however tempting it is, there's nothing to be gained from venting your politics because you know that half the room's going to
smack the head and the other half, I don't want to offend those people. And I mean, listen, we're all very polarized right now, especially in the U.S. And I have very strong opinions about a lot of things, but you know, that's not what they're coming to me for. So I'm trying to like, just kind of keep it, like give them a little escape from everything and just keep it light.
Well, you can put it in the pages, can't you, one way and another with your
you can, yeah, it's a fine line, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah,
but I know there's a lot of people who feel very differently about that, and I respect that opinion. Yeah. As well, it's just, you know,
the books have, although that you say there's a change in tone between Fatal series and Gansett and the other series, in terms of where you pitch them, because I know romance goes from squeaky clean kind of Christian sweet romance through to erotica at the other mm-hmm. spectrum, and where you kind of plant yourself, I guess you can't vary too much in that sense with your reader base.
So I actually have a very erotic series that did really, really well for me, which is kind of funny, Quantum. And I finished it last year. Hollywood heavy hitters, actors, producers, cinematographers, directors, they're all like, they're a production company, and they're all sexual dominance as well. So that was really fun and really different for me. It was the first time I ever also wrote first person present. I had been third person past all along, and I really switched it up and discovered a whole new groove with first person present that I really love. And it's my preferred thing now. So all my new stuff is in first person present. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a very strange, and you ought to see, like, writing third past in the morning and then first present in the afternoon, like.
Right. Messes with your head. But did your existing reader base migrate across? Were they new groups
they did.
Of readers?
They did. Some of them were a little slow too, because they were kind of afraid. You know, I think I might have made a mistake in like kind of billing it as this real departure. I shouldn't have done that, because I think it took some of them a while to kind of come around to trying it, because really, like, my core story is about family, whether it's the one you're born into or the one that you create for yourself. And the Quantum team is very much a family of people who have come together through their careers and formed a family. It's a work family, but, and there's, you know, there's one guy who's an actor whose parents are big stars. They're like, the dad's a big actor and the mom is a big singer, and they're just like Hollywood royalty, you know? So there's one kind of like nuclear family that kind of like everybody rotates around, but in the office setting and in their playtime and their off time, they're together all the time. They're like siblings, you know? So, that core story, even though there is a sexier element to it, is still very present in that yeah. series. And the readers really responded to that.
Yeah. Oh, Marie, we've been chatting. It feels like 5 minutes. It's been knocking on an hour.
Oh, wow.
So fun. It's so much fun. Yeah, yeah. Well, I love talking to you. It's you know, catching up with you has been amazing. And I remember vividly that first interview and being so impressed with how you'd built your universes on paper, but also built this real universe with your readers. And
Thank you. They're really special people. They have been very good to me, and I never forget that. So
yeah. And now we're getting almost Marie 2.0. We're full on indie.
Yeah.
Are you going to do Mark's course now?
I am doing Mark's course now. Yes, I am. And listen, you're never too old to learn new tricks, right?
Do you know what? I think the Prestazon module, I don't know if you've come across it yet, is part of Ads for Authors, but I'm just wondering if that might be right up your street now, just to take some of the time away from the nitty gritty of doing Amazon ads.
I'll check that out for sure. Yeah. I will. And one of the things I just want to add this too, is like, I have been really, really, really plugging. People need to take Mark's class, because there's a lot of money spent on a lot of different things in this business, publicists and, you know, people doing stuff for you and, you know, trading off with other authors. And I just have to say, the one thing that has really made a huge difference for me are free books, first in series, you know, that you really, and ads. And the ads was a big thing before. I was doing it myself. And now, like, I'm really seeing like how much bigger it could be with me doing it. So if you have a small amount of money to spend on anything, I say spend it on the next time Mark opens the class, because it's money that you will never regret spending.
Well, that's lovely of you to say that, Marie. Thank you very much indeed. It keeps me in my day job as well, which I'm delighted about. And I promise you, next time we speak, I will have published my first book.
Come on, James. I mean, really.
Well, now I know I've got to go back to bed in the morning to write it, which I'm...
That's the secret. Yeah. It is the secret. I say I'm a romance author. I do my best work in bed.
Yeah, there you go. That's a cover quote I need.
That should be my author tagline, yeah, right?
For sure. Marie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, James.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
I just love Marie Force. I mean, I love her dedication. I love her work ethic. I love her bright and breezy approach to life. I love the fact that she writes the stories and is almost like a reader writing them, wondering what's going to happen next. That's how she approaches writing. So when fans come up to her and say, what's going to happen to Johnny? She can genuinely say to them, I don't know, but I'm waiting to find out.
Yeah, that's a pretty good good state of affairs as an author. If you're as excited about what comes next as your readers hopefully will be, there's a good chance that will transfer across. So, I mean, it's a pretty, if you're managing to do that, you're doing something right.
And 8 million books, Mark?
Yeah, that's twice as much as me. So she's absolutely crushing it. She's incredible.
Yeah, and huge numbers of books as well. So we love Marie, and I really hope we can meet her one day. Well, I might have to go to one of her fan conventions in, is it Rhode Island, isn't it? I think she's in.
Somewhere like that, yeah.
Yeah. I shall go along and be a fan. Great. Okay, well, thank you very much, Marie. Lovely to have you on. We will have you on again, I'm sure, when you get to 10 million books in probably not that long.
Next week.
And well, fascinating to hear that she's doing your course, Mark. She's back down. We knew that because we had a couple of emails from her just sorting out some access issues. Mm-hmm. And she's slimmed down her team. She wants to go back to self-publishing basics, ramping things up again. And that's, you know, just goes to show, doesn't it, that if Marie Force thinks you need to learn the nitty-gritty of advertising, the nuts and bolts of it, and she's not above it, neither are you, neither am I. You know, we can take on this stuff. We can learn something and be better every day. Okay. That's it.
Okay.
You look like you were going to say something.
No, I disagree. Absolutely agree.
Be better. Be best. What was that thing that came up in politics in America a couple of years ago? Be best. Or best this. Anyway, let's leave America politics for now. And all that remains for me to say is that it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.